bed, doing this, doing that. If you put a star for each time they do it, that makes a huge difference to the child.
Right.
It makes a huge, huge difference. I remember one time I was, back in the day, I was driving an Uber car, right? I was an Uber driver. And I picked up a father and his son, I think, and one of his friends. And he was talking with his friend about the system that he used. He said, I taught my kids how to use Excel, Microsoft Excel, and how they can do a formula to calculate their rewards. So he said for every action, there would be like $2. Right. Or like, I don't know, like cleaning the house, doing this. For each one is $2. And the kids would come into the Excel spreadsheet, and they would put the money. Like today, I washed this, and they put the money. And Excel automatically calculates how much is being made.
Right.
So the child could literally see his money moving. So what makes the child do? He will look for chores that he's not even asked to do
just
to get money.
Especially because he sees the progress.
Exactly.
In front of
so
his
he
eyes.
Said, the father said, I have, and I was very impressed by this. He said, I have a list of things, and each has a price in the front of it. Like doing your bed is $2, for example.
Right.
Brushing teeth is $1.50. Helping your mom in the house, maybe $3. Depends on how big the thing is.
Right.
And the child says, you know what? I want to make $5 today. So I'm going to brush my teeth, do my bed, help my mom.
Right.
And he can go to spreadsheet and he puts it in and he see his money actually making. And that just it drives the child crazy to becoming a good person. Now, easy system, but extremely effective.
But of course, it shouldn't perhaps only be with money. That shouldn't be the only incentive for
a
child, right?
No, of course not. But we're saying that's the idea, is that something that they like. For example, like I said, see what they like. And give it to them, right? If they like money, for example, say them, okay, money.
It's very rare that children understand money. They understand the things that money buy.
Okay, for example, a bike. For example, say, you know what? I'm going to put a star system, right?
Right.
For all the work you do, I put a star. If you reach 50 stars, I'll get you a bike.
Right. So it's the concept of the reward
system. The concept of the reward that we're talking about. How you form it is up to you.
Right. We will take a quick break, dear listeners, and we'll be back shortly.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Welcome back to your listeners. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. So there we are speaking about the whole concept or philosophy of the system of reward. Do you say it? Please enlighten us even further.
Up to here, we were saying that when it comes to the rewards, first we said it has to be something that the child likes. Two, it has to be suitable for the child's personality or his identity, something that's suitable for him. For example, if he likes to be thanked and praised and rewarded in front of his friends or siblings, then do so.
Right.
And make that a priority. You know how we said there are three things?
Three rewards.
Positive rewards.
Materialistic, activity-based ones and social ones.
So if he prefers, for example, the social reward, make that a priority.
Right.
If he prefers the materialistic reward, make that a priority.
Right.
If he likes, I don't know, other types of reward, make them priority. So give him something that's suitable to his liking.
Right.
Okay, so you use the system that's suitable to his liking. And obviously when we said if you want to reward him with something that he likes as well.
Just a side note here, because some might listen to this and say, then the reward should always cater to what the child wishes. But the parents naturally must also think, is this suitable for the child, even though he likes it? Because some children may be like candy, and they give them like a lot of candy, a lot of candy, a lot of candy. They should also know that there is a balance, right?
No, when we say, yeah, exactly. So this is...
Because some people listen to this and they go completely off the hinge.
Exactly. It's a sensitive point. When we say give them what they like, it doesn't mean that whatever they like, you give them. For example, my son likes to play games. And he wants me to buy him 1,000 games. I'm not going to do that. That's destructive.
Exactly. Yeah.
For example, I would say to him, okay, I'll give you, for example, one game every 6 months. And I have to choose the game, for example. but not to deprive him of everything. Like I said, with sweets, for example, children like to have sweets. I'm not going to give him all the sweets.
For just example, simple example, because you said, for example, that some children like to be rewarded in front of other people.
Mm.
And that can have perhaps disastrous effects in the future.
Wanting to be rewarded in front of people, usually it always falls, most of the time, falls under the social reward.
Right.
That's what they want in front of their peers. They're not interested in you giving them, I don't know, an iPhone or an iWatch in front of their friends.
Right.
It doesn't make a difference to them. So that he would be more happy to have it alone and no one actually sees it and touches it, and then he goes and shows off.
Right.
So if it's in front of his friends, he would like a social reward.
Right.
With his family, maybe he likes that family reward where you thank him and you encourage him and stuff like that. So, like I said, each child would have his own kind of
preferences
when it comes to rewards. You tap on that.
Should a parent ask the child what kind of reward he wants, or should that just be based upon the observations of the
parents? It is good. It is excellent way to ask the child what he wants, because then again, you know. And as a parent, you make a choice. If the child says to you, okay, I want this, you say, well, okay, should I get it? Should I not get it? Is it good or not good?
Right.
If you find it's not good, you try to find out a way where you can change their mind in a nicer way,
right.
So they leave that alone and they choose something else. For example, just give them choices.
Right, makes sense. Dear Said, I must thank you for your insightful knowledge, and I must thank the listeners for tuning in. As usual, if our dear listeners have any suggestions or questions or other feedback, they can contact us at our email of englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, they can also find us on our various social media accounts, under the call handle of Call of Islam on, for example, Instagram or on Facebook. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining me on today's episode of The Lantern. Coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Here's the thing about life. It doesn't always go as we want it to. That may come as a surprise. But And naturally, you'd think that, well, it's my life. It should go as I plan. And things should run according to me and my preferences, my comfort, my convenience. But that usually isn't the case. And oftentimes, life has a way of turning out and unfolding the way it should, rather than the way we would want it to. And good news is, it's okay. That's absolutely fine. Do not panic. Everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world if life does not go according to your plan. Let's listen to a short story about this, and I'll explain how it's related to what we were talking about. And we'll be right back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam, peace, and salutations of Allah the Almighty be upon all of you. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. It starts like there once lived a wealthy man who was bothered by severe eye pain. He consulted many physicians, but none could treat his ache. He went through a myriad of treatment procedures, but his pain persisted with more vigor. He looked and for every available solution for his pain and approached a wise monk renowned for treating various illnesses. The monk carefully observed the man's eye. The monk told the man to concentrate only on green color for a few weeks and avoid any other colors. The man was desperate to get rid of the pain and was determined, ready to go to any extent. The wealthy man appointed a group of painters and purchased barrels of green paint and directed that every object his eye was likely to fall to be painted green. After a few weeks, the monk came to visit the man to follow up on the man's progress. As the monk walked towards the man's room, the appointed painter poured a bucket of green paint on the monk. The monk could see that the whole room was painted green. As the monk inquired for the reason for painting everything green, the wealthy man said that he was only following the monk's advice to look at only green. Hearing this, the monk laughed and said, "If only you had purchased a pair of green spectacles worth just a few dollars, you could have saved a large share of your fortune. You cannot paint the world green. Dear friend, let us change our vision and the world will appear accordingly."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at a story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
See, if you go out on the street, right, and you look for red cards, suddenly, all you will see in the street is red cars. If I came across a beautiful quote and an explanation from one of the lecturers. And he was saying that sometimes it's easier to let a feeling pass rather than focusing on it and trying to figure out where it stems from and how do I resolve it and this and that. This doesn't mean that we should not try to analyze and understand our emotions and our state of being, but sometimes it's just easier to overlook things and let it slide. If I am in a gathering and suddenly I feel, I'm quoting the lecturer, and I suddenly feel like a cloud of, you know, negative emotions hanging over me, and if I try to focus on it too much and try to figure out what caused it, then I will start remembering all the mistreatments and all the awkward moments I received and experienced during this little gathering, and then that dark cloud will naturally grow bigger and bigger. And then that will just add to my negative vibes. And before I know it, I'm officially in a bad mood. Basically, what I'm trying to say is life is all about how we choose to perceive it. I know this sounds really, I don't know, wide-eyed or overly optimistic, but it's true. And it takes years and years of practice in order to really master the fine art of looking at life through rose-colored glasses. But it is possible. Everything in our life, in this universe, depends on our perception. And my proof for my theory is the Hadith Qudsi, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, I am in the dhan of my abd toward me. I interact with my servant according to how they perceive me. If I perceive Allah, worship Allah, understand Allah, recognize Allah, acknowledge Allah as a kind, merciful, forgiving, generous, beneficent, giving Lord, a God that I can rely on in every aspect of my life, a God that resolves all of my issues and problems because it's His job, because He's the Almighty, because He's the All-Knowing, because He is my provider. And I am constantly in a state of absolute need toward Him. I depend on Him in every aspect, every dimension, every detail of my existence. Then God is going to treat me thus as well. And God will resolve all my issues for me as He has promised Himself in another hadith where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, if my servant relies on my other servants in their affairs, I will just leave them to those people. But if they cut their hope from all other beings and only rely on me, I will suffice them. Imagine what happens when Allah suffices us. The creator of heaven and earth, the designer of this universe, the provider of all living and non-living things, would suffice us, would be enough for us, would directly and personally manage our affairs and issues for us. We would be needless of everything and anything else, right? Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
in the limelight.
A new study by Environmental Working Group scientists finds almost 42,000 potential sources of the toxic forever chemicals known as PFAS that could be polluting surface water or drinking water in communities across the U.S. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Nearly 42,000 Sources of Toxic Forever Chemicals Put U.S. Drinking Water at Risk, Study Shows. Stay tuned for more. Bolstering calls for stronger PFAS regulations and more testing, a new analysis released recently finds nearly 42,000 potential sources of toxic forever chemicals that could contaminate drinking water in communities throughout the United States. In their peer-reviewed study, which was published in a special issue of Water Science, Environmental Working Group EWG scientists examined the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency EPA enforcement and compliance history online database to identify potential sources of PFAS and polyfluoroalkyl substances, that is PFAS pollution, in the U.S. surface and drinking water. According to their investigation, solid waste landfills, wastewater treatment plants, electroplaters and metal finishers and petroleum refiners were the facilities that appeared most often as possible sources of PFAS contamination. Dubbed forever chemicals because they don't break down and can persist in the environment and bioaccumulate over time, PFAS are a class of synthetic compounds that have been linked to adverse health outcomes, including a weakened immune system, reproductive and developmental harms, and an increased susceptibility to cancer, among other negative effects. EWG researchers point out that discharges of PFAS with industrial wastewater are a major driver of surface and drinking water pollution, putting the health of tens of millions of Americans in jeopardy. Despite these risks, the paper notes the vast majority of water systems nationwide lack both the technology and the funds to filter out forever chemicals. It is critical that the EPA start regulating PFAS now. David Andrews, the lead author of the study and a senior scientist at EWG, said in a statement, adding, "Every community in the U.S. is likely affected by PFAS contamination, but those living near or downstream from industrial facilities may be more at risk." Investigation identifies a huge number of potential sources of contamination. It also provides a framework for deciding where and what to test so we can end releases into the environment, unquote. The paper includes case studies of data available from California and Michigan, which show that PFAS pollution is common at a variety of sites, heightening the importance of widespread testing for forever chemicals in wastewater. Andrew said the results from states like Michigan show there is a wide variety of sources of PFAS in surface water. Many landfills and industrial sites release PFAS at detectable concentrations that may exceed state limits or health guidelines for PFAS in water. He added that it is urgent that ongoing releases of PFAS be identified. We need to stop non-essential uses of PFAS and use filters to reduce these compounds from our water. Getting forever chemicals out of the country's water supplies remains a nationwide challenge, EWG stressed, adding, but it's one that can be met through comprehensive tests of surface water and drinking water, along with tests of wastewater from potential PFAS sources. In July, the U.S. House passed the PFAS Action Act of 2021, which would improve the federal oversight and facilitate the cleanup of forever chemicals, but the U.S. Senate has yet to take up the legislation. In the meantime, EWG implored the Biden administration to use the EPA's powers to regulate as many industrial categories of PFAS discharges as possible, calling the agency's proposal to regulate just some releases of forever chemicals into the U.S. drinking water inadequate to end the pollution flowing from companies. Scott Faber, EWG Senior Vice President for Government Affairs, said that we need to turn off the tap of PFAS pollution from these industrial discharges, which affects more and more Americans every day. That's the first step. The second step is for the EPA to set a national PFAS drinking water standard, and the third is to clean up legacy pollution.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Military coups are yet again becoming a common occurrence in Africa. After recent military takeovers in Mali, Chad, and Guinea, it was the turn of Sudan. Last September, a group of Sudanese army officers purportedly loyal to deposed President Omar al-Bashir led a failed military coup. Now, this is how the national TV announced the unsuccessful coup. Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the alleged military coup in Sudan and the political and economic crisis in this country, which has also abandoned its long-term support for the Palestinian resistance. In today's show, we shall also look at how employees of the World Health Organization have been involved in sexual abuse in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us till the end of our show and let us know what you think by posting your comments on our social media pages.
Sudan's coup attempt and transition woes. Sudan's fragile transitional government says it foiled an attempted coup that was linked to the ousted regime of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Following the coup, political leaders and army generals, who have always been at loggerheads, have now made their differences public for the first time since signing a power-sharing deal 2 years ago.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok further claimed that the coup attempt sought to target the revolution's achievement, stressing that it was orchestrated by Paris from within and outside the Sudanese army. He said it was necessary to reform security institutions after the coup.
The failed coup attempt clearly indicates that it's necessary to reform the military and security apparatuses. It calls for an all-out reconsideration of the transition process and the necessity to forge a partnership based on the values and principles of the revolution towards a civil, democratic transition only.
Well, for an incisive analysis on the coup attempt in Sudan, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, first, tell us what, in your opinion, was the reason behind the recent coup in Sudan?
Well, according to the government, they were people who were loyal to the former regime of President Bashir. There's questions about who was actually involved. They claim that 21 people were arrested in a plot to overthrow the government and perhaps reinstall President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. It's still not clear exactly the dynamics of the attempted coup. They claim it was centered in Abdurrahman, which is a twin city of Khartoum. So it looks like it was a power struggle, perhaps within the military apparatus of Sudan.
Well, some sources in Khartoum claim the recent failed coup, just like other reported attempts, had been fabricated by the current military rulers to win the sympathy of Western countries. Mr. Azikiwe, there have been unconfirmed reports that the recent coup in Sudan was actually fake and was planned by the military itself. Do you agree with this viewpoint?
No, I think there are definite differences within the military and also within the political apparatus that are part of the Sovereign Council, the Transitional Sovereign Council. I believe that there are sharp disagreements over fundamental issues involving the composition of a potential legislative council, the question of Sudanese relations with the United States, relations with the State of Israel, and also its relationship with some of the states that are heavily allied with the United States and Israel.
Mr. Bayomi Ezekiel of the Pan-African Newswire. Stay tuned for more.
Bitter recriminations followed the attempted military takeover in September. The facade of unity presented by both the civilian and military members of the Transitional Council has been wiped out. This has now thrown the future of Sudan's transition into deep uncertainty. Mohamed Al-Faqi Suleiman, committee leader and member of the Joint Military-Civilian Sovereign Council, Sudan's highest authority, asked people to be prepared to return to street protests if necessary.
We will defend our government, our people, and the democratic transition to the last drop of blood. And if there is any threat to the democratic transition, we will fill the streets and be at the forefront, as is our responsibility.
Is there a possibility that the current tensions might derail Sudan's transition to civilian rule and plunge the country into more chaos?
It could. They are not able to bring about a stable transitional dispensation. There's been no real date set for multi-party elections throughout the country. The government seems to be more preoccupied with pleasing Washington and Tel Aviv rather than actually looking out for the well-being of the nearly 60 million people that live in the Republic of Sudan. So they have to be concerned about the economic growth of the country. They have to be concerned about bringing a myriad of political parties and mass organizations, civil society organizations, into the political fold inside the country. They've been negotiating with these various rebel groups from Darfur and from the border areas. Some of them have committed to a political dispensation and others have not. So it's going to be a struggle going forward in order to achieve real stability in Sudan.
The people of Sudan have suffered immensely following their country's separation from South Sudan. The armed insurrections in several parts of Sudan, especially South Kordofan, Darfur, and Blue Nile, have their roots in the decades of conflict between the Khartoum government and the southern regions, which ultimately led to the secession of South Sudan in 2011. The situation in the country is now getting worse since the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir in 2019.
Sudan has seen increased protests by angry masses over poor economic and political conditions. What's really happening in Sudan right now?
Perhaps it is the inability of the Transitional Sovereign Council to meet the needs of the Sudanese people. They have to, in fact, resolve these issues politically. They tried to link the protests in the eastern part of the country to the attempted coup that took place several weeks ago. Whether or not there's a direct link remains to be uncovered, but these are some of the dynamics that the Transitional Sovereign Council has to deal with. The interim Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, is really at the mercy not only of the military in Sudan, but also the international forces of imperialism, which are dictating to him what his policy should be inside his own country.
Now, Western countries condemned the failed coup attempt in Sudan, expressing support for the transitional government, which is increasingly unpopular among the masses in the country.
We were expecting a speedy transition to civilian rule. We don't actually feel there is a transition to anything here yet. Today, there is no freedom, peace, or justice in Sudan.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, do you think foreign powers are involved in the current political crisis in Sudan, especially by backing a regime which appears quite unpopular among the masses?
No question about it. The United States pressured Sudan under the previous government of President Donald Trump to normalize relations with Israel. They also required that they pay millions and millions of dollars in restitution for terrorist acts that were carried out. And there's no direct evidence that the previous Sudanese government was even involved in these acts. The bombing of the USS Cole in 2000, the bombing in 1998 of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Yet, they made that a precondition of delisting Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. So this is an ongoing process. And even today, despite all these measures that have been taken by interim Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, the country is still suffering from food shortages, fuel shortages, high unemployment, and impoverishment.
Amid growing ties between the Khartoum Transitional Authority and the Israeli regime, Sudan's military rulers have confiscated and taken control of all assets that they claim to have provided backing for the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas on its soil. In response to the report, Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri rejected the claims of the Palestinian Resistance Movement's investment in Sudan. Why have the authorities in Sudan decided to take action against Hamas at this point in time?
According to sources inside of the Sudanese interim government, they were given a list by the United States of companies and organizations and institutions to close down and to seize their assets. And that's exactly what they have been doing. Over the last several months, they have shut down the resistance movement, Hamas, and they have seized assets which they claim belong to Hamas. But this is something, too, that's been engineered by Washington and Tel Aviv.
The normalization agreement between Khartoum and the Israeli regime provoked a furious backlash from the people in Sudan. Masses in Sudan have slammed as treacherous any ties with the Israeli regime. A resident of Khartoum here says normalization with Israel does not serve the interests of Sudan.
This is the treatment. أنا بلدي دي بناسي بالسودانيين بالناس اللي فيها ممكن يختموا ونبقى أحسن من إسرائيل ونبقى أحسن من أمريكا ونبقى أحسن من الناس كلها لو تكاتفنا وحطينا يدنا مع بعض.
Now our last question to you. Clearly, the move by the regime in Sudan to seize Hamas-linked companies is a betrayal of the people of Palestine. What's your take on this?
It is a betrayal. Historically, the Republic of Sudan has been a close ally and supporter of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. In 1958, they passed the Israeli Boycott Act, which prohibited relations and economic interrelationships with the State of Israel. And now they have reversed this entire process. And it's been done largely through the interim government. There's been demonstrations in the country. A number of political parties have signed statements in opposition to this normalization with Israel. And I think it's going to increase, the opposition is going to increase as the impact of these policies become clear to the Sudanese people.
Well, thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe, for your incisive analysis. Here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on the unfolding events in Sudan. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is about a sex abuse scandal facing World Health Organization workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
WHO scandal in the DRC.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
An independent investigation commissioned by the World Health Organization has identified more than 80 alleged cases of sexual abuse during the Global Health Agency's response to an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, the scandal has implicated at least 20 WHO staff members.
WHO staff knew of the allegations in early May 2019, but it wasn't until October 2020 that an independent commission was established. Although the commission was established in October 2020, it took investigators nearly 7 months to start interviews in Congo, where Ebola killed some 2,300 people in Ituri and North Kivu provinces between August 2018 and June 2020, the second deadliest outbreak ever.
Speaking during a media briefing by the independent commission that probed the scandal, WHO Director General apologized the victims.
The first thing I want to say is to the victims and survivors of the sexual exploitation and abuse described in the Commission's report. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what was done to you by people who were employed by WHO to serve and protect you. I'm sorry for the ongoing suffering that this event must cause. I'm sorry that you have had to relieve them in talking to the Commission about your experiences. Thank you for your courage in doing so. What happened to you should never happen to anyone. It is inexcusable.
Now to discuss the abuse scandal facing WHO employees in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, our first question, what really went wrong and how was it possible that WHO staff abused people they were supposed to actually serve?
The problem is that it's a power imbalance. The people control the resources of almost unlimited power, and then you have women that are in a desperate social situation, many of them starving, and they would do anything to get jobs or to get food, or even, as one lady said, to get a basin of water just to clean herself. So that power imbalance is the root cause of the problem, and there weren't safeguards in place. The World Health Organization did have some training programs, but only a small percentage of people that were hired undertook the training.
Now, although the commission recommended that reparations be considered for the victims, that's unlikely to happen in the UN system. The co-chair of the independent commission urged the WHO to consider compensating the victims.
Victims for the first reports of incidents until the completion of preliminary investigations. And finally, to also mandate this working group to reflect and make proposals on the possibilities of granting reparations to the victims at the end of duly initiated investigations, starting with the conclusions of the independent commissions in this case.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, do you think the WHO will act on recommendations of reparations or compensation to the victims of the abuse scandal?
I have seen no information to say that the WHO is going to pay reparations or compensation to the victims. However, I think this is something that they should do at a minimum in order to ameliorate the situation and to help these people overcome what had to be a traumatic experience. So I hope the WHO does provide compensation to the victims, because they're at fault because they did not properly screen the workers, and they did not put training sessions in place, and they did not protect their own employees and people that were volunteering or working with the WHO, and that is grounds for that they should pay for some sort of reparations and compensation.
The abuse scandal in the DRC raises serious questions about the WHO's top leaders and why they were unaware of the extent of the problem. The WHO Director General, for example, visited Congo 14 times during the Ebola response, while other staff made even more visits. This abuse scandal clearly points to deep flaws in international humanitarian operations. The WHO Director General has also admitted that the organization needs to regain the trust which has been dented by the Congo abuse scandal.
And ensure more effective human resources processes. Already, we have taken several steps to improve our HR practices in recruitment, onboarding, induction, and training. We will also take steps to integrate standards of behavior relating to sexual exploitation and abuse in performance management, starting with leaders and managers.
How have these cases of sexual abuse affected the credibility of the WHO in the DRC and across the world in general?
This is definitely going to hurt them, and it also, I think, hurts some of the other organizations, including work from the United Nations and peacekeeping forces, and people should be aware that this problem is unfortunately quite common when you have such a power imbalance between the people who control resources and demand sex and those who are desperate to get some sort of employment, even food, water, whatever. And this is not going to help the WHO, but as I said, World Vision, UNICEF, other medical organizations, and certainly peacekeeping operations have experienced the same problem, and they should be aware of this, and they should take measures to safeguard the women and young girls and anybody else who is subject to exploitation and abuse.
The investigating commission recommended that WHO imposes disciplinary action on those who fail to report potential sexual exploitation and abuse incidents. Now, Mr. Corrigan, what other measures should WHO take to prevent such incidents from recurring in future?
Well, we have to send a strong message that if you rape people or you abuse your position, that you're going to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. We also should have proper training sessions in place for people so that they're aware of these rules and regulations, and that they have to be sensitive to respecting the people that are working with them. And the WHO should have some sort of supervisory role and inspecting people, and also notify that if somebody is trying to exploit you or abuse you, that you should report this to the people who are running the operation so that they could take strong measures. The WHO tried to avoid these problems and get caught up in bureaucratic delays, and they also were overly concerned about whether or not these reports are in writing, that they're true. But they were trying to avoid dealing with this issue head on, but now that it's become public and they should be aware, this is unfortunately not an uncommon problem, and they should take strong measures to prevent it from ever happening again.
Thanks, Mr. Corrigan, for your input. We do hope that serious action will be taken to stop these wanton abuse of African people by these so-called international aid workers. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Bafrica Today. Don't forget to drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's topics. God bless you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to your program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, in this episode, we are going to discuss the virtue and value of work. Work, earning, and toil have particular manners in Islamic Sharia. We should first answer some important question about work. Is there any value for work in Islam? Now, this is the main question that we are going to address. Probably you would say yes, or maybe the answer is definitely yes. If the answer is yes, then what are the limits actually pertinent to the issue of work? What are the hudud or the laws that we have to take into consideration when it comes to work? We have to deal with the moral value of work, and we shall study the manners of work in this episode particularly. When it comes to the value of work and earning, we have two groups of verses, or maybe we can say two sets of verses and narrations. The first of this narration, or the first set of these verses and narrations, contains more texts, speaks favorably of work. I mean, the first set of the verses and narrations speak in favor of the work. They promote the worth of workers and wage earners. And as far as the second group or the second set of narrations and the verses are concerned, they speak disapprove of gathering means and wealth. Now, we have to understand these two sets of narrations and maybe verses in their proper context. Because if, for example, there is a verse or there is a narration which says that we should not gather wealth, we should not gather means of livelihood, then we should understand it. What does actually such verse mean in the first place? Now let's begin with the first set of narrations.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
God Almighty, God the Glorified, says, وَجَعَلْنَا النَّهَارَ مَعَاشَ, and we have appointed the day for livelihood. So, this verse is simple in its purport and its concept. It says that we, God the Almighty, actually set and appointed the day for livelihood. So, the day is for work and the night is for rest. That is for sure. Because in the dark of the night, you cannot work and you cannot earn your living. Although in modern time, of course, there are people who work at night and there are people who work day and night. Anyhow, it's better to work during the day because the day is appointed for this purpose, for earning your livelihood. And also there is a verse in the Quran which says, وَلَقَدْ مَكَّنَّاكُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايشَ قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ. We provided you therein with means for the fulfillment of your life. Little it is that you extend thanks. It means قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ. You are grateful very less often. But وَلَقَدْ مَكَّنَّاكُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايِشَ. It means that we have provided you with the means for the fulfillment of your life. We give you the capacity, we give you the power in order for you that you can live your life and you can earn your life, and we also provided you with the means and everything so that you could earn your living. So this is one of the verses which speaks favorably and which is in favor of working. Of course, working is good in and of itself, and of course whoever works is like a mujahid. Al-kaddu li'ayalih kal-mujahidi fi sabilillah. A person who works for his family, he is like a mujahid. He is like a person who fights in the way of Allah. And that's the tradition from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. A well-known tradition. Al-kaddu li'ayalih kal-mujahidi fi sabilillah. Someone who endeavors, who toils for his family, is like a mujahid. Someone who endeavors in the way of Allah. And when it comes to these two verses which I just recited, they indicate the divine favor and blessings bestowed upon human beings in terms of the fact that God has made the day for their